drifting orbit, but it did have a slight change in height and elevation. That's why it would sometimes, you know, the orbit would be a little less. It would appear from your vantage point on the ground, it looked like it kept passing by and came back a little bit and then it went out again. That's the way it appeared from the ground. It wasn't happening that way, but because we're circling underneath it, it had that you know, seem like that. AMSAT has promised us this year we might well have a satellite. We will, I think not. I think that they're having a money flow problem, but I'm happy to see that just recently they have the funds over 100,000. It was down around 26,000 for almost 2 years, and now all of a sudden it jumped up well over 100,000. So evidently funding is coming in. And I think you may have mentioned, because I got in here late, that the Germans, AMSAT DL, is working on one. They might get theirs up ahead of ours. I don't care. That's great. Everybody wins. And that's also going to be this new satellite that AMSAT's working on, and the one that the Germans are working on, is going to be this bilinear orbit. I don't think any amateur satellite has ever achieved a true bilinear orbit, and maybe that's why these orbits seem to look a little strange to us. Back over to you, Dick, and 2MB.
Very fine. A geosynchronous orbit is something like 22,300 miles above the surface of the Earth, roughly 6 Earth radii out there in space.
Over the equator.
Oh, and it's got a very good point. Exactly over the equator. To be geosynchronous. To be, now wait a minute now. Yeah, geosynchronous, geostable, gotta be over the equator. You could be inclined with the equator and still have an orbit that's exactly once every 24 hours, but to a ground-based observer, it'll appear to trace out a small figure eight in the sky. So, geostable orbit is what we're talking about over the equator. Geostable has to be exactly over the equator, and it's one-dimensional real estate. You've only got a longitude for your attitude, for your position, a particular longitude, some number of degrees west or east of Greenwich, and exactly over the equator. And as beautiful as that sounds, it's an unstable position because there are mass concentrations in the Earth. There's one in the Southern Atlantic and one in the Pacific, where everything that's in geostable orbit wants to slowly drift toward those mass concentrations in the Earth. So periodically you have to do a burn on your satellite and then to reposition it. You fall out of that 1 square mile and you're going to start paying a fine to the Intelsat people and maybe running into other people's birds and start being a great big liability risk problem.
Has there ever been a real collision?
Yes, I think there has been one, but it's not very well advertised. I keep hearing hints about it from time to time. It was a military bird, and whether or not the collision was intentional or not is in doubt. So I think there has been a collision, and it's certainly possible. They're going to be a little bit worried about that. Now, when it comes to the Molyneux orbit, I believe the Molyneux makes 2 orbits per day, but one of them, of course, you make sure it falls at the desirable position over your particular territory, like Siberia. I'm not sure whether or not it does go above. I'm going to take your word for it. We said it goes up to 58,000 or so, almost 60,000 miles in the apogee. Are you sure that that's 60,000 miles, or is it up? And if so, is that around 100,000 kilometers, Barry? Thank you for a quick point on that one.
You know, pretty sure that is the case, yes. Remember, these amateur satellites, they're not achieving what would be a true bilinear orbit. They're achieving something close. And in the case of Oscar 40, they were very worried about Oscar 40 decaying into the Earth's atmosphere, or the low part of the orbit. So they kept pushing up the low side. And I think that has something to do with the high side going up as well. You'd think the high side would come down, but it didn't. It made everything go up, and they did that because they wanted to get ahead of themselves. They knew they had no more fuel, so they just put it as high up as they could possibly get it. And, of course, the satellite never did decay into the Earth's atmosphere. Unfortunately, it failed for battery reasons, but the idea was good.
WS2N.
All recognized. I'm all good ahead with your information.
If I recall, amateur, Oscar 40, that was the phase 3 D that the Barry's mentioning, was a 10 to 1 ratio. I think the low point was 4,000 miles, and the apogee was 40,000 miles. I remember this 10 to 1 ratio that they had. So I think that was it. I know that orbit does go further. You've got the Chandra Space Telescope that goes out to the 60,000 range, I believe. But I think the Oscar 40 was 40,000 out. If I'm not mistaken. You know, we can check on the internet, but back to you, David.
Great point. Now, if you and I own the satellite, Barry, and if we're worried about the perigee, the part closest to the Earth starting to hit the atmosphere, and you've got a little bit of fuel on board that you can burn, you're going to burn that fuel at apogee, opposite of common sense. In other words, whatever you do in a orbit, whether it be a circular orbit or elliptical orbit, doesn't matter. The maximum effect of the velocity change is always felt 180 degrees away, the opposite part of the orbit. So if you make a burn to increase the velocity while you're at apogee, the net effect is that you will raise the altitude of perigee. So from what you're describing, it sounds like they did their burn. It sounds like they did their burns at apogee to raise the perigee to make sure it wouldn't touch the atmosphere, to make sure that they would have longevity of that particular burn. The good news is they raised the perigee. The bad news is they changed the timing. As you would do anything to increase the velocity of orbit, the amount of time of the orbit increases. The orbital period increases. Again, opposite of common sense. You would say, hey, if I make a burn in a forward direction to increase my velocity, you would assume I'm going faster, and therefore it's going to take less time to make the orbit. Well, Mother Nature's got a little bit of a trick on you there. You make the slightest change in velocity, you make a huge difference in altitude somewhere else in the orbit, and as you make the change in altitude, the total period of the orbit changes accordingly. So all orbits become faster and faster in miles per hour as they get lower and lower if they were a circular orbit, just to keep things simple. The moon, as you can tell, is out there very far, but by comparison to any man-made satellite, it's moving very slowly, something like 6,000 miles an hour, whereas a satellite in low Earth orbit is moving 17,500 miles an hour. So velocity is altitude, and the secondary effect of that is more altitude, takes more time to make an orbit. Edward, any further comments on all this before we leave this beautiful subject? Give us your call letters, K2RIW, the second night.
WX1.
Go ahead, Paul.
You know, a fun thing to do is, if you have a globe sitting by, look at the globe and figure that's 8,000 miles roughly in diameter. And the geosynchronous satellites are set at 23,000 miles out. So roughly three times that distance is what you would be looking at. If you take a measurement of the surface of the globe, and then you look back at it, and it's amazing how far that satellite is really out. Now, you compare that to the low Earth satellite, such as the shuttle, and that looks like it's almost, you'd be skimming along the surface of the globe. It's such a big difference when you think about geosynchronous. And then when you talk about 40, or maybe it is 60,000, as Barry mentioned, wow, that's unbelievable. Especially when you actually physically look at it. Thank you, Dick.
No, but when it comes to the scale of things, you'd be amazed how often people miss the scale. When you've got that globe of the Earth sitting in front of you, we all know that the troposphere, the major portion of the atmosphere, is 6 miles high. But the radius of the Earth is around 4,000 miles. The diameter is around 8,000 miles. Therefore, the thickness of the atmosphere on the Earth is not much thicker than the paint that's on your globe. The average guy, when he draws a picture of the Earth and he draws a picture of the atmosphere, in his picture on the paper, he makes the atmosphere look like it's about 20% of the diameter of the Earth. In reality, it's an extremely small percentage. It's about the thickness of the paint. And so a low Earth orbit satellite is just a few thicknesses of the paint out from the surface, where a synchronous orbit is either 6 Earth radii, or as Paul put it, 3 Earth diameters out. Another place where people make a huge error in sizes is when they make a picture of the solar system. We draw a nice little sun in the center, and we draw the 9 planets going around it. In reality, if you drew it to scale, and if you made the solar system, if you made the sun the size of a tennis ball, Pluto would be down the block a ridiculous length of distance. During the time that the most recent satellite, Spirit and Opportunity, when Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars, if you made a scale model of Earth and Mars during that landing, where the two were separated by almost 400 million miles, Mars is one half the diameter of the Earth. So if you try to make a scale model, a 50-cent piece and a dime are almost a 2-to-1 ratio. 50-cent piece and dime, where 50-cent piece represents the Earth and the dime represents Mars. In order to make those two at the scale distance, you would put them half a mile apart. Let me repeat that. 50-cent piece and dime, Earth and Mars respectively, at the instant of landing of the Spirit and Opportunity on the surface of Mars, that scale model, 50-cent and dime, would be half a mile apart. What NASA did was to launch from the 50-cent piece and a year later very accurately land on the right letter of that dime half a mile away. It gives you a little bit of a gut feel of what kind of accuracy is required to do this and what the scale of the solar system and these planetary and satellite orbits are. When we draw the diagrams, we all lose the scale.
Before you probably have a better memory than I do. NASA has a website, and I can't remember the name of it, where you can go to it, and you'll get a visual view of
the fancy dial-up here, Barry, so I'm kind of stuck there. In fact, I've even given up trying to get a NASA TV. The inputs of the all these programs are outrunning the equipment of the computer. Kind of like everybody riding around, driving around in gas-powered cars. All of a sudden they said, well, now we're going to put hydrogen in everybody's cars, and I'm still riding around with a perfectly good gas-powered car, and I can't do it anymore. So I'm getting kind of frustrated. And then to bring this scenario further, can you imagine a couple of years later them saying, well, no more hydrogen, now we're going to go on, nuclear fuel or something. That's it. Watch your hydrogen car, it's no good anymore. That's just what's happening here. So I can't help you. Go to the NASA site and you might be able to do it. Of course, Google definitely has it. I'll respect
you. You doubled with somebody for a couple of seconds, Paul. Was there somebody out there giving us the website for that NASA thing which shows you all the birds in orbit in a three-dimensional diagram?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name. It's W2GGT. Dick, that site is still there, but it's no longer supported, and NASA's basically telling you, go use this private site instead. I forget what the private site is, but if you find it, God, I can't remember. J-Track. J-Track, was it? J-Track 2D and 3D.
You're right. That's what it is, J-Track. Very good. And Paul, I bring up J-Track with a dial-up connection. I, too, have a dial-up connection. It works just fine on a dial-up connection. Please try it. Thank you, sir.
J-Track, is that what he's saying? Juliet?
That's what he's saying. And although it will take you a while to load it with your dial-up, and I guess your dial-up is probably running 40 or 50 kilobits per second on a good day, at the salt mine, I've got a T1 line that runs at least 1.5 megabits per second. That ain't fast enough at times. No matter what bandwidth we got, we want more, particularly when you're displaying real-time video. We're all eventually going to have fiber to the curb. It's the only thing that's going to give us the bandwidth and the insertion loss that we can tolerate. It's just a matter of time. You guys have to eat your vegetables, stay alive long enough. You're all going to eventually have fiber to the curb. We're all going to have OC192 or OC384 standard optical data at 10 megabits per second, or 10 gigabits per second. OC192 standard is 10 gigabits per second. And 384, I think, is 40 gigabits per second. That's data. And that's going to eventually come because, at least in the metro areas, there is a demand for it. They're willing to pay for it. It ain't that expensive. And once the hardware is installed, wow. That will be your bidirectional communication link for broadcast, telephone, internet, everything. That's the prediction that a lot of people are making. And so, over-the-air broadcast right now is eventually going to become through the cable fibercast or arrow casting. A lot of people predicted that. We'll soon see. We amateur radio operators who just love radio wireless type techniques, we're going to hang in there until the bitter end, I can tell. When it comes to giving up over-the-air broadcast, I ain't going to do it. I am the only human being that I know of in my town that still has an operating television aerial on the chimney of my house, and I watch over-the-air broadcast television with it. Every other person that I can tell in my town is watching a zillion channels of either satellite by way of the 18-inch dish, DirecTV type satellite, or cable TV, or the combination. I do have the old-fashioned satellite and over-the-air broadcast, and it serves me very well. But the cable company thinks that there must be somebody dead in my house because nobody is using either of those cable services or direct television services in my house. When it comes to the area of Brooklyn where Mel lives, he believes he is the only human being in that part of the town. In that county, he may be the only human being that has an operating television aerial on the chimney of his house. Everyone else has flipped over the cable. They all want 200 channels at a time. They all want to watch... they all have their favorite 5 channels, but they want the 250 channels there. It's like the New York Times. You don't have to read it all, but it's nice to have it all there. And these guys that just love cable and satellite, they run a zillion channels and want to brag about it. As far as they're concerned, Mel and I and Barry and maybe Paul, we're dinosaurs because we're still using the old technique. I wonder the last time you walked around your neighborhood, Mel, how many operating television aerials were you able to see? I recently walked around my neighborhood, and I could not find one. K2KEY, K2YWMSX, Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, whatever one can see up there is pretty bad shape. The seed line and all is the old-fashioned. Many of them have the old-fashioned 300 ohm line just waving in the wind. Just waiting for somebody eventually to go up there, maybe when the roof is going to be repaired, cut it down. But if you look up my yard here, where the cable runs, you can see everybody is hooked on to the cable. So, yes, that's against them. I'm the only house that doesn't have it connected here to the house. Now, I guess, oh boy, deluge of mail offering all kinds of deals. 3 months free and this thing and that thing and all and why and where and please call us whoever discusses. Representatives come to the house and ring the bell. What do I need it for? The only time I turn TV is on usually this thing when I used to go to work in the morning. Catch the weather and the traffic report. At night, catch the news at night. Once in a while, Channel 13 runs something interesting. Like something like you're talking about satellites or something that is major and all, but so we send a donation every year to the CBS on station report. In fact, I think it ranks now as the list, I don't know for how long now. If you told me Channel 2 through 11 or whatever it went off the air, I wouldn't even know it. I could say we're a dinosaur. I just can't find anything on TV. really worth looking at. So I can't see, you know, the expenditure of a large screen set or getting the cable in. I'm not going to get a bus. I'm not interested in the movies or the popular culture things at all. We just don't have no interest in it. So I can't see, you know, the expenditure to go ahead.
WS2, any comments from Mel?
Go ahead, Paul.
I got a show for you, Mel. You want to hear it? It's an hour show, but you'll be happy going through the first, let's say, 3 minutes of it before the show even starts. You'll love it. It just came on. You want to hear it?
Why not?
Okay, Mel, very good. Just want to make sure you copy me. The name of the show is called Jericho. The word Jericho. And what do they have coming across? I said I don't believe it. It's a new show that just came on. Wednesday night, 8 p.m., Channel 2. And I got a kick out of that. I couldn't believe it. And luckily I recorded it, so I played it back a couple of times to make sure I heard what I was hearing. And it's kind of noisy, you know, they make it like a little noise in the background there. Actually, the noise in the code is about even, I would say, the people in DB. But I got a kick out of listening to that. Back to you, Mom.
Hey, Paul, what's the reason that they're sending the word Jericho in Morse code, do you think?
Well, I watch more TV than you guys, so I sat through it. It's pretty good. It's the town Jericho in the middle of the country somewhere. What happens if there's nukes going off around the country here and there, and if one town gets isolated? And this is going to be a weekly show. So last week was the Wednesday was the first show. So naturally, they're going to be. In fact, they're looking for the one ham radio operator in the town. So I'm sure he'll probably be a part of it maybe as the week go on. Back to you.
I recently did a survey. What I discovered is that the most watched programs on television right now are TSI Miami, Lost, Desperate Housewives, and one other. Each of those four or five highly watched shows, which last for 1 hour, gross $12 million per hour just for the advertising. I'm not talking about the show itself, the reruns, the residuals, and whatever. Just the advertising for those four shows for 1 hour is $12 million of cash flow. That amazes me. That the public is so sucked up with these slightly more modern-day sitcoms is what they really are. And if you sit back and think about what you're watching, is it really educational? Is it really beneficial? Yes, it's entertaining. And to do that once in a while, I can understand that. But just to show you another area where I'm running into a problem is that I get almost every week, either New York Times or Newsday will call me up and say, we will give you the paper free of charge on the other days. I get New York Times about 2 days a week, and I get Newsday about 2 days a week. And they call me up and say, if you extend it for the other days, for the next 3 months, the next 6 months, we'll give it to you free of charge. And I say, no way, Jose. I just came out of a drastic situation where I was working all kinds of hours with a client that needed a rush job, and it lasted 3 months. During those 3 months, on a few of those days, I worked a 24-hour day trying to ship that piece of hardware and time, which we did manage to do that. But the point I'm getting at here is those newspapers that I only get a couple of days per week, I've got them piled in my living room. I've got them piled for the months of March, April, May, and June. I haven't even seen them yet. I'm not even sure I'm going to get a chance to see them because I was too busy doing something else that was a high priority to me. And just when they call me up and say they're going to give the newspaper to me for free, the price is right. But where in the house am I going to put them? So when it comes to the news, there's a certain amount of it I can tolerate, but I'm doing that during time on this, what to me was a very important project. If it's successful, someday you guys are going to hear about it. A really fancy piece of electronics. If it's successful, we'll see. Okay, I think we've gone through Gabe Gordon. We had a quick conference with Mel. Of the other guys who signed in, most of them gave leave me a no. But just here's your last chance, fellas. If anybody else has a question before we go over to Paul and Mel's final comment for the night, if anyone else has a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW.com.
My comment is, can you be open?
KC2MDV, Steve, yes.
Wow, we had a quadruple there. Richard was the first one I heard. Steve was the second one, MDP. There was the third one. Who was that?
W2TNJ Bob with a comment.
Can Richard also comment on the equal segment of electronics, KB2MAR again?
Okay, Rich, KB2MAR. You said Rich. Oh, Rich, you meant me, but it's Gabe. Okay. Rich and 2EO first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, just a side comment on the television. Some little coincidence. One of the shows I watch in the afternoon is All in Order on TNT Network. And a couple of weeks ago, they do a fictitious story, and it says, Stewart Electronics, Flushing, New York, Peter Rubin. And I said, oh my God. So I called the guy up, it turns out his son is one of the writers on the show. All I got to say is against Toledo. That's my favorite.
How about that? Real reality. And these so-called reality shows where they put people on a desert island and have them compete with each other. I'm having great difficulty figuring out how anybody can get emotionally involved in that highly made-up phony situation. Is that the modern-day equivalent of what they think is lost, and even lost is pure fiction? Yes, it's entertaining, but if you spend a lot of hours of your life watching that particular kind of more modern sitcom, I don't know, you need a hobby. Maybe you guys should be taking up electronics that do that. Okay, Steve, KC2MDP, go right ahead with your comment or question.
Very good, Dick. I'd like to say good evening to you and to everyone else on the net. I'd like to go back to the discussion we were having earlier with water in the cable. Basically, is there any indication, you know, where you get a higher SWR reading with a little bit of water in the cable? And aside from the connectors, you know, water migrating into the jacket itself, is that more of a moisture thing or is that more of a rain thing? And do you think maybe if you were to take like some PVC pipe or something, like sweep the cable up your tower as like an extra protection from the elements, that would help as far as water migrating into your cable? Back to you, Dick.
A very good set of questions there, Steve. And I've lived with water for years on UHF systems. My solution when it comes to the array of 16 Yagis on 432 on top of a 100 meter tower, the best antenna I ever built. Many of you guys who have seen my QSL card, my red QSL card, has this 5,000 cubic foot antenna, which was constructed at the 100 foot level of a tower, and I'm standing in the middle of it at the 100 foot level in that photograph. I'm very proud of that thing. That has 29 dB of gain, and it allowed me to have all kinds of long distance contacts on 432 with that antenna. That's the good news. What I did was to insulate every one of the 16 driven elements on the 16 Yagis. They were all insulated from the boom so that I could stand in the shack with an ohmmeter, go between center conductor and shield, and I could tell if there's any water in that system, I thought. When it comes to most of the air-filled cable going up there, if I measured something like 10 megohms in that whole system, I was assured there's no water in the connectors and there's no water in the air-filled cable. And when water started coming in, I would see it come down from 1 megohm, half megohm, quarter of a megohm, eventually got down to 50 kilohms, as you really got a lot of water in any one connector, and I knew I had to do service. That's the good news. So by measuring with an ohmmeter, I could tell. However, even when I kept the water out of the connectors and out of the airline, when that array finally came down after Hurricane Gloria, removed it from my tower for me, and deposited all those antennas into my front yard, I went out there and measured the insertion loss of the foam-filled FM8 cables, the federal cable, which was the Cat and Meow in 1978, was an FM8 cable. And the water had slowly migrated into the cells of the foam of the dielectric of that cable. It did not show up on an ohmmeter. but every one of those pieces of cable had three times the insertion loss that I measured when I first installed them 4.5 years earlier. So when you get water in the foam, you can't even tell with an ohm meter. You cannot tell by standing wave ratio. You can only tell by insertion loss. Water at these frequencies is the world's best dummy load. I know because Mr. Southworth, the guy who invented waveguide in 1938, used a trough of water at a slanted angle. He put his waveguide at a slanted angle into a long trough of water, so there was a wedge of water inside of the waveguide, and that became an extremely good dummy load where his reflection coefficient was like 25 dB down. All the RF energy slowly got introduced to that wedge of water, got absorbed, turned into heat, and as long as he's running at a low enough power that he's not boiling the water away, it worked like a charm. So, if you've got an air-filled cable and you've got a great big chunk of water at one spot, yes, it will show up as a medium amount of standing wave ratio, like 2:1. But if the water is slowly distributed through the foam, giving you a distributed insertion loss, no, it will not show up with your standing wave ratio meter. It will not show up with your network analyzer. It will not show up with your time domain reflectometer. It's very insidious. So water inside the foam is a killer. And the water slowly, I think 80% of the time when we get water in our cable, the water is usually coming in because the connectors breathe. So doing heroic things to put, what do they call it now? This putty-like substance, what's it called? Coax seal. By putting coax seal on the connector and wrapping tape on top of it, whatever, and spraying with Krylon or the equivalent made by Rust-Oleum, the ultraviolet protected equivalent, all of these things are good to seal the connector. A lot of water gets in by the connectors themselves leaking. But if the cable you're using is a flexible cable with foam as the dielectric, and if there isn't a hermetic sealed foil alongside of the outer shield, if it doesn't have that foil, the water will slowly migrate through the outer polyethylene jacket and slowly get into the foam. It takes a couple of years to do it. Common sense would lead you to believe that if you have no nicks and cuts in that outer polyethylene jacket, it should be keeping all the water out. That polyethylene jacket is a perfect weather seal. You talk to mil spec specifications, it is not a hermetic seal. In other words, the rate at which the water vapor migrates through that polyethylene outer jacket is something that can easily be measured in a good laboratory, and it is continuously happening. Opposite of common sense, it's almost the equivalent of buying Gore-Tex clothing. Gore-Tex claims that it makes very fine pores, that the moisture being given off by your body gets through the pores, but the rain doesn't come in. So therefore, you don't get overheated. It's not like a raincoat, and it becomes an ideal parka or jacket for the wintertime. And so your polyethylene jacket has some of those properties. I am guessing that if you looked at it under an electron microscope, you would find out it is mildly porous, and the water vapor slowly migrates through it. So if you really want to keep your cable dry, and really keep it low in insertion loss, you're going to be using either air or foam, and the outer jacket has to be either a hermetically sealed foil or hard conductor aluminum or hard conductor copper. That's the only way I know of to keep water vapor out of the foam. Once it gets there, it's going to make the insertion loss go up, and you might not know it. Really nasty. Ain't that something, Steve? KC2MVP? Are you as surprised about that as I am, K2LAW, at the TechNet?
Yes, I am. You know, so I'm thinking about it. You know, I got some cable that's been out there a couple of years, and, you know, this discussion got me to thinking, you know, maybe it's time to do a little more of an aggressive approach and try and keep the water out of there, or just start changing some of those old coax cables out. And as far as, let's say, like, you know, even like a pipe or even like some of that flexible copper tubing, if you were to sleeve coax through there and then just try and do your best as keeping water out of the connector at the antenna as possible, do you think that would help as far as keeping some of the moisture and water out of your coax? Thank you.
PNJ with a comment. PNJ recognized. I think the answer, Steve, is no. Good common sense would lead you to believe that the PVC jacket is a pretty good seal. But then how are you going to keep the moisture from collecting inside the PVC jacket that you're creating? There's going to be an airspace inside the PVC tubing. Even though you've done a good job of sealing over joints, there's airspace between it and your transmission line. That airspace must breathe. On a hot day, that air is going to expand like a power piston. On a cold day, it's going to contract. The worst condition is a hot summer day where the air inside is hot and expanded, and all of a sudden a cold rain comes along, immediately cooling the cable. Any moisture that's in any end of the cable is going to get sucked in. Even if the only open end is inside your house, on a nice, dry winter day, when you and your wife and your son take a shower, for periods of time, the moisture content in your house is significant. And that cable breathing is going to breathe that moisture, that PVC pipe. Therefore, the moisture is there. You've slowed it down a little bit, but it's still going to migrate into the cable. Unless the PVC pipe was pressurized with dry nitrogen or dry air, I don't think you're willing to go through all that effort. On top of that, the amount of effort required to put your transmission line inside of PVC is significant. I'd much rather see you spend your man hours and dollars buying a quality piece of cable or going to your nearest stockyard where the cable TV hardline exists and begging that guy, handing him money over the fence, doing whatever is required to get that material in your hands. That's the only thing I know of that is a perfect hermetic seal as long as you properly install the connectors. And because the foam inside is a good closed cell foam, even if you did a poor job of installing the connectors, the water would only migrate for the first 6 inches into the end of the cable. It would take years for it to migrate all the way into the middle of the cable. And if you discovered that happening, just hack off the last foot of the cable and reinstall the connector. To get around this problem, I've got to have a flexible link that goes around my rotator on the tower. I use RG9 or RG214. Solid polyethylene, old-fashioned cable is my flexible link around the tower. Anybody looking at that, say you're a modern-day microwave ham radio operator, how the hell do you tolerate the insertion load of polyethylene cable? And my answer is there's only 5 feet of it there. Therefore, the insertion loss is a tenth of a dB, but solid polyethylene will not breathe water. All of your air-filled and foam-filled cables will breathe water. And to have the flexible link going around the rotator, sucking up water and developing 5 and 10 dB of loss would bother the hell out of me. So I use a mixture of materials there. Let's see how Bob solves that problem. W2PNJ, KQRIW, the tech man.
I'm just listening to the mail. Makes good sense. Just a comment as far as waterproof and making the connected watertight doors that are on the outside is the electrical supply house like NNS in Huntington or Schling Electric in Farmingdale. They sell, or Great Bar in Hapbox, they sell the shrink tubing for like the RG8 size, the shrink tubing for 1 watt THHN conductors. It's about an inch in diameter, unshrunk. And on the inside, there's a gum coating. And the shrink tubing is maybe about 8 inches long. And they use that for like a direct burial splice, where you have a crimp and you want to make it watertight. Because when you heat that down with a heat gun, that gum will just impregnate that jacket, that connector, and ooze out the end.
Beautiful suggestion, Bob. I know that if you're willing to pay for it, Andrew, that makes Andrew Heliac Coax Cable and a few other brand names, will make for you a kind of a shrink tubing that goes over the connector that has the goop inside. And when you heat that up with a heat gun and shrink it down, it gives you a much better weather seal than you're going to get with tape. Now, a lot of guys will wrap tape over the connector, black electrical tape, and they assume that's pretty good. However, the way you put the electrical tape over the end of the connector is a problem. Your Type N UG21 male connector at the end of the cable has a diameter, I don't know what the number is, but maybe it's about 3/4 of an inch. The cable itself, the RG8, RG214, is around 450 thou in diameter, and there's a great big step between the two. No matter how carefully you wrap tape in that area, you're going to end up with an air gap under the tape. And any air gap is going to be expanding and contracting on a hot and a cold day. That's the laws of physics. You can't stop that from happening. And each time it expands and contracts, it's going to be sucking in moisture. So therefore, you've got to fill up that space with something like coaxial, or you could put multiple layers of tape in there to build it up as an inclined plane. But the nicest way to do it, in my opinion, is to fill it up with a tar-like substance, coaxial. So even with this shrink tubing that Bob is telling you about, even properly installed, it's going to have a little bit of an air gap where you've got that great big transition in diameter on the back end of the connector in the beginning of the cable. You've got to fill that up with some kind of putty-like material, like coaxial or, what do they call it, monkey snot, is another slime that people use for this green stuff that they use on anechoic, that they use on environmental testing chambers. It's a very sturdy, putty-like material that doesn't get hard. So either that or coaxial. And by the way, your Home Depot does sell a black substance in a great big, putty-like black substance for sealing windows. They sell it in a great big brick for only a couple of bucks. Beautiful stuff. You pack that into the back of the connector so there's a nice inclined plane, and it acts like a strain release where the cable leaves the connector, you've got this stuff packed in there, and then you put your tape and or shrink tubing on top of that, and you've done a darn good job of sealing that connector, in my opinion. I know this sounds like, much too much effort required, but keeping water out of a cable is really a lot more art and science than first meets the eye. Think about every chunk of air, whether it be inside the foam, whether it be inside your 9913, or whether it be in the gap on the back of your connector. Every chunk of air between a hot and cold day outside will expand and contract. Therefore, it's going to breathe, and it's going to suck in water if you don't do something to avoid it. And you'd be amazed how many times you can have a great big pile of tape around the connector, and you think you've done a good job. And if you could look with your x-ray eyes inside, the answer is, maybe it ain't good enough. Anybody have any further comment, Preston?
EJ with a comment.
Go ahead, Bob.
The trouble with electrical tape is you wrap that tape and you stretch it to break it, when you're done, that thing will peel back. It'll come back to its normal shape. You have to be very, very careful in applying electrical tape. My suggestion, you get yourself a tube of silicone grease from Granger, high dielectric. It comes in a large toothpaste tube. We use it for high voltage connection. Put some gum up there, those steps and valleys you're talking about, and put some heavy grease on, silicone grease on that. And the grease is water white, clear as water. And then put the shrink tubing over that, heat it down with the shrink gun. And I want to tell you, you're not going to get any air gaps or air spaces in that. You shrink from the middle out to the end. You don't shrink from the end towards the center. You start in the center, you heat it in the circle, and the shrink tubing comes in all different sizes and lengths. You got to get the kind where you put your fingers down, you can feel the sticky gum, and you look inside of it, it's very shiny. That's the kind that they use for direct burial. And those things will be absolutely watertight. No water will get in, and if you put the silicone grease on those steps, you will eliminate the pockets of air.
Rather good suggestion, Bob. Now, I'm going to have a further question for you, Bob. And that is, first, they do make this white stuff, what do you call it now? Coax stuff, or just plain stuff. They make this white, foamy, Teflon-like material in a tube that some people go the next step and fill up the center of the air gap inside of the working end of the type N connector. And so, although it disturbs the impedance a little bit, it gets rid of the air space there to make sure that no water can crawl in. I'm a little bit sly on silicon grease is such a beautiful lubricant that I don't like the fact that your shrink tubing might not make a good bond. I would much rather use coaxial, but that's me. And the silicon grease that you guys use, I don't know if I would like to put a great big chunk of that because you've got this huge step in diameter between the back end of a type N connector, a UG21, and the beginning of your RG8 cable. It's much too big a space there to fill in with grease. I'd much rather fill it in with this tar-like subsystem. But the heat shrink tubing that Andrew makes for their connectors has a life on it because the goop inside eventually dries out. So this heat shrink tubing is made for a single-aught cable for grounding wiring, whatever that you guys use. I wonder if there is a date code on that heat shrink tubing. I wonder if you threw a piece of it on the shelf and 8 years later you come back and you want to use it. I'm a little afraid that the goop inside might be dried out and may not do the right job. You might have an opinion on that one, Bob. W2PNJ, KTRIW, glad you're around for all this info.
I've never seen this stuff dry and crack up. What I've seen dry and crack up is duct seal. We're requiring, when we do the transformers, the pad-mounted transformers, the new 15 kV primary cables has an outer... years ago, it used to be the concentric neutral was on the outside, direct barrier to the earth, but now they have a polyethylene jacket on it. And when we cut that jacket back, they want us to put a ring of duct seal on the transition, on that step, some duct seal, and then put the shrink tubing over that, and then shrink it down. This stuff is absolutely watertight. I mean, we've done jobs where we got primary laying and salt over at Captain Bill's restaurant on Bay Shore, which is 300 feet from the water's edge. We had 8 inches of salt water in the bottom of the transformer wall, and we've never had a problem with that shrink tubing. Right here, Smithtown Water District, we did a direct burial flight using the same shrink tubing with the silicone grease. And when you heat that down from the center out to the edges, that gum just comes pouring out. So you know you got an absolutely watertight, airtight connector. And that stuff stays gummy. I mean, I've never had a call back. I'm 36 years in business, and I've never had a problem with it after that.
W2VL, repeater.
Well done, Bob. Very good information. Here's my next question. When you use the heat gun that's made for shrink tubing, it comes out with, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 800 degrees or 600 degrees Fahrenheit air, and it's got a fancy curve on the end, so it curls the air around the cylindrical object. You're trying to shrink down the heat shrink tubing. It does a beautiful uniform job. Very few of us own one of those heat guns. It's an expensive industrial tool. Almost every one of us wants to use a propane torch out in the weather to do that job. In your opinion, can a propane torch used with skill, waved back and forth and around the cable, do a medium good job? Or would you recommend you go out and buy one of those heat guns and everybody share it in the club? WTPNJ, TQIW, the 10th man.
W.W. Granger has the heat gun. I've never used the heat gun with reflective shield on it. You could probably use your wife's hair dryer, too. Some of those big ones are pretty hot. Very dangerous in using the Bernzomatic torch. I do have a torch that we use for large heat shrink, but it was Raychem. I bought it from Raychem in California, and it puts out a very fat, soft flame with the propane bottle. A very soft flame, very large, but very soft. Because with the standard torches you have at Home Depot, you got a good chance of burning it up.
I'm relatively sure that the hair dryer used for a human being cannot, under normal circumstances, come to that temperature. Yeah, if you do something to seal off the input air vent so that the airflow is down to one quarter of normal, and now the kilowatt of heat generated by that coil inside will make the inside of that machine glow, and it might even melt the plastic. Then you're going to get enough heat to do a good job of heat shrinking. But a hair dryer for a human being, I'm convinced, Bob, cannot run up those temperatures without creating a huge liability risk of, burning people. I may be an old grandmother, but I'm very unhappy whenever I go to a barber shop, and at the end of cutting my hair, they spray a little bit of water on it in order to make it lay correctly so they do the fine cutting. Then they want to get rid of the water by using this heat gun on my hair. and a few places where I can feel the heat on my scalp. Boy, that to me is uncomfortable. I think they're cooking the daylights out of my 65-year-old hair, which I think is shortening its life, and I'm not sure they're doing good things to my scalp. So even the heat that comes out of the hair dryer at a barber shop, in my opinion, is much too hot for my head, but much too cool for doing heat-shrink tubing correctly. So I'm skeptical that a hair dryer can do it unless you modify the heck out of it. That Granger product, how expensive is it? And this Raycat torch-like thing, how expensive is that, Bob? Thank you.
Granger heat gun is about $50. Not bad at all. The Raycat torch, I think, was even more money. It was like a 3-foot hose with the nozzle, handle the nozzle, and the pressure reducing valve on it. That was about $130. I bought it many years ago. That's going to be hard to get. You'll have to get online with Raycam to get that. But the heat guns, I forget who makes it, but the Ranger handle sells them. He has still two or three models. This is the cheapest one, and it works great under all kinds of outside air temperatures. A hair dryer would probably work on very small heat shrink, like if you're going to put a piece of shrink on a connection on a quarter, half watt resistor.
Okay, now the problem with the Granger is it requires 110 or 220 volts. When I'm on top of the tower...
110.
Okay, yeah, 110 volts. When I'm on top of the tower trying to shrink that piece of tubing, I ain't got 110 up there. And if I did have 110 up there, I'm really pushing my luck when it comes to human safety. So we've got a huge problem with that, getting the power to the darn heat gun on the top of the tower, or even on the roof of the house. It's kind of risky to run a great big long extension cord up on the roof of the house where you're holding on to the copper flashing, which might be grounded while you're doing this work, or touching the television aerial, or even just touching the coax cable itself, which in most cases is grounded to the tower. For lightning reasons, it's grounded, so is your equipment is connected to it. So running 110 volts to the heat gun, the Granger heat gun outside, is a problem. I'm unhappy that Raycat thing is that expensive, $130. And you said you got to stand on line at Raycat to get them. Apparently it's not a popular product, often sold over the counter. And maybe your Great Bar or a Granger company doesn't have one of those torch-fired things. I wonder if there's a way that we can put a great big flaring tool on the end of a burnt somatic. I do remember a flame flaring tool on the end of my burnt somatic. I wonder if that could be carefully done to do a right job. Are you worried about the burnt somatic being too concentrated a chunk of heat, and if it's not done with skill, melting the portion of the heat shrink tubing that you're trying to shrink down? Is that what you're concerned about, Bob? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the fishtail attachment, if you have that, that'll do the job for you. Gray Bar handles Raychem, if you're interested in the gun, because Raychem makes that snow-melting conductor. You know, depending on the temperature, it becomes more conductive, the lower the temperature, negative coefficient. And if they sell it, the only stuff that's UL-listed for wet locations, like to put in your rain gutter, if you want to keep ice out of the rain gutter. Raycam makes a beautiful product. It comes in 100 to 150 per bowl, and they sell you the whole kit. And it's the only item that you will listen
to. The weight of the ice does terrible things to the store in my gutters, and every springtime, I've got to go through a whole lot of labor to get them back again. I think what you're describing is the kind of the heat tape that they put in the gutter that melts the ice. How expensive is that? And I imagine you're going to be very careful with the weight you power to that heat tape to make sure that your whole gutter is not 110 volts above ground. That's the business you're in, Bob, but we're talking about human safety, what ham radio operators run into. So in this case, don't worry about mentioning commercial brand names and whatever. We're talking about keeping people alive here. Any information you can give us along the lines of keeping ice out of my gutters, I think the people listening would appreciate. W2PNJ, glad you're around, Bob. KQIW in the TechNet.
I got on the TechNet to ask a couple of ham radio questions, but what I'm going to do is I got to go down in the shop. I have a box of that heat
You know what it looks like? It looks like oval, picture 300 ohm, but fat, like a large insulation. And what I emphasize is the only item that's UL listed, the wet location. And that's what, for an electrician, that's what we go by. It's been tested by Underwriters Lab, and it's the only one that carries the label. And it comes with a complete kit how to make the devices, the connections, termination of the end. And the warm weather, it doesn't conduct. The colder the temperature, it starts to conduct. And it gives you, maybe a watt or two per foot of heat that is dissipated on it. It does a fine job. Take it back. I'll go downstairs. I'll get the box. I'll bring it up, and I can tell you what the model number is.
Fantastic, Bob. We're going to hang around and wait to hear your beautiful information. And if there aren't too many other people with questions, we're going to take our time out right now for Paul to tell us what's going on in space. So have we covered the questions up till now? Give me your call letters if not. K2RIW in the tech net. Go right ahead, Eric.
W2VL, repeat it.
You got the floor, Eric. Modulation of the picture itself. By comparison, you go over